Okay, guys. Well, I hope you all had a great, happy new year. We certainly did, and we're glad to get back at it for 2012, hoping this is going to be a great year for everybody. I think it will be. As you know, I sent out an email regarding today's conference call and what we were going to discuss, and I was talking to Clyde Kober, and he thought, you know, he had an interesting comment for me, and it was a good comment and something that I think many of you will be able to participate with good info for some of the newer franchise owners. And what he said to me was, Dave, he said, you know, I hear some of the older franchise owners talk about value added and how they add value to their customers. And he said, what is that, Dave? I mean, you know, if you just look at it from, you know, from 100 feet away, you know, we do handpiece repair, Shine offers handpiece repair, Jeff's handpiece repair offers handpiece repair. How are we different? How do we add value to our customers and thus differentiate ourselves from the competition? And it was just something that I think in my everyday working with you guys, I just know intrinsically that you guys add value to your customers. Whether they know it or not, just what you do on a daily basis adds great value to their practice. But Clyde said, Dave, what does that mean? You know, what is that? So, you know, I sent out that email in hopes that many of you would kind of think about it and think about what you do to add value to your customers on a daily basis. But at the same time, I came up with a couple of pages here, so if I start to get a little bit long in the tooth, I'd be happy to have someone like Alex tell me to be quiet and let him or someone else talk. But I did want to start out with at least discussing with Clyde and for everyone else out there who wants to know what I perceive and what is probably perceived by your customers as your value-added service. So I basically broke it down into three component parts. Number one, the expert and superior service that you provide, and then we'll go into that. Number two, the quick turnaround time on repair. And number three, your more affordable pricing. So those three things in conjunction add great value to your customers, and I want to go through those three things individually. So I'm going to start by just talking briefly about the expert and superior service that you all provide. It's a personal service. In many cases, you deal with doctors and staff in person. Your customers, for instance, are Lisa and Cindy at Dr. Potter's office, not customer 12387-2 in Region 4. In addition, when they call you with questions or concerns, you speak to them directly and work fast to help them, and they don't have to talk to a call center in New York City or who knows where. Now, I know with us, personally, we deal with Shine's corporate office. We deal with Midwest. We deal with Cavo on a limited basis. And we are, I have to tell you, every single time I call, I generally talk to a different person, and they don't know who the hell we are. No matter how many times I've called them, no matter how many times I've sent something in that we just had to send in, we're always a customer number. They always ask you your zip code, your phone number. They have no idea who you are. And I laugh because I don't care personally, because I like that they do that, because I know when Dr. Potter calls the Cavo, they're getting the same amount of respect, which is essentially none. You're just a customer number to them. In addition, you're calling New York City or whatever. They're not calling you in their same town. In addition, the hand pieces are all you do, and you apply your years of knowledge and experience to best work on their instruments. That's in comparison and contrast to, let's say, a manufacturer where the guy walks in the office, the rep, and he's responsible for basically a 1,000-page dental supply catalog. He doesn't know much about or probably care much about anything about the repair. And all he does care about are the 30 pages in that catalog, which are new handpieces that he wants to sell the doc because he's going to make a commission off of it. So the personal service that you're providing is just automatically, with those three to four things I just listed, way far and above anything they're going to get off of a manufacturer or a dental supply company guy walking in the office. In addition, one thing they'll never offer is in-house maintenance training to their staff. In addition, you can offer follow-up support and even offer maintenance training PowerPoint presentation that you all have so that they can quickly train new staff members and get them up to speed on handpiece maintenance. Most of the reps that walk in the office barely know what an autoclave is. They could probably point to it and sell them a new one, but they don't know any of the procedures and information that's good to share with the doc so that they're not burning up the handpieces in the autoclave or washing the darn handpiece and breaking the bearings, etc. Now, much of that, which I'll go over now, is included in that five-step checkup. Now, part of the service that you provide would be that five-step checkup, which includes five different things, which I'm going to go over briefly here, to essentially eliminate any of their warranty issues. One of the problems, probably the biggest problem, as you know, 99 out of the 100 things that can go wrong with a handpiece are directly related to what the offices and staff are doing with their handpieces after you've fixed them and given them to them. I mean, at 350 to 400,000 RPM, if a handpiece isn't working right, it doesn't leave your shop because you know it's not working right. So if you get that handpiece to that doctor, 99 out of the 100 things that are going to cause that handpiece to fail prematurely and eventually, you know, even 10, 12 months down the road, naturally are directly related to what they're doing in their office. So they can blame that, you know, that they don't like Midwest handpieces or that they don't like Lair's handpieces, or, you know, they can throw all these different things at you and, oh, well, why shouldn't I go lube-free with the Star? And it really doesn't matter, because if they're doing all the things right in the five-step checkup, they're never going to have any warranty problems. A perfect example would be my own dentist, who has three Lairs at my dismay. And she had nothing but warranty problems with them because they were that lube-free Lairs. Well, I've got them doing all the right maintenance things with their other handpieces, so I told them, well, why don't we do that with your Lairs handpieces? And so they started doing that in March and April, and I haven't seen the handpieces since. So we're at 8-9 months, going on 10 months on those Lairs handpieces, which they couldn't get to last 4 months. When they were the lube-free model. So anyway, let me quit rambling about that and go through the five-step checkup for some of the newer franchise owners who kind of want to hear again what that is. It's five steps, and first and foremost, you need to make an appointment with the girl in the office who's responsible for the handpiece maintenance, because that's who's going to be your key person to getting your handpieces to last through warranty and far beyond. So number one, you want to check for proper inventory levels on high speeds. If short, you can either offer refurbished handpieces or new handpieces. But that's number one. If they've got three operatories, they've got to have 9 high-speed handpieces. If they have 5 or 6 high-speed handpieces, no matter what they're doing with their maintenance and the care of the handpieces, they're just overusing them. So they're probably going to fail prematurely, or at least they're going to fail before they should. So you want to make sure they have the minimum of 3 high-speed handpieces per operatory. Number two, you want to check for their proper slow speed and attachment inventory. Now, often this is an educational process for the offices, because many of the old-school docs who've been around for 12 to 15 years in the business think you just do high speeds. When this business first started, everybody was out there promoting high-speed repair. Nobody was out there promoting the slow-speed repair, because we didn't have the parts, we didn't have the training, we didn't have the schematics, and in many cases now, even factory support. So this is an opportunity to both get their slow-speed handpiece repair and also to become the source for all of their attachments, you know, the nose cones, the latch heads, the contra angles, and even new and refurbished slow speeds. So although you're checking their inventory on their slow speeds, really, I always consider that part of this five-step checkup as an educational thing for the docs who don't know that you can do that. The third thing, which is now when we get into kind of the nitty-gritty on what would cause a handpiece to fail other than them simply not having enough handpieces, would be to check the in-office air pressures. at each operatory. Now, all of you have an air pressure gauge and you know how to use it, but do you use it? That's the important thing. Do you get into the offices and check their air pressures? It's a simple process. It takes just a couple of minutes, and it's key. If they're low on air pressure, they're going to have real low torque on their high-speed handpieces, and they're always going to think something's wrong with them. I'm just not getting any torque out of my darn handpiece. That's usually not the case. It's pretty rare that you walk into an office and their air pressures are low, but you will, on rare occasions, run into that. So you want to make sure they're at the properly recommended air pressures. Now, if it's high, what they're going to end up doing is they're going to end up blowing out bearings. They're typically going to have great torque, which is good, but they're going to blow through bearings. So at that point, it's kind of an education process as well, where you got to let them know they need to get the air pressures into the certain range that's recommended by the manufacturer so they get maximum handpiece life. The next step is educating them on proper sterilization procedures. This includes making sure their autoclave is set at the proper temperature, or in the case of a statum, that it's set for the hollow wrapped long cycle. Obviously, if the temperatures inside the autoclave are too hot, that can damage the bearings. You also want to confirm that they're using the sterilization pouches, or autoclave bags, as many of you call them, and that they are being placed in the sterilizer paper side up. This avoids overheating inside that bag, and it also allows the water vapor inside the handpiece inside the bag to escape, which eliminates those internal lines from rusting. As many of you know, you'll put a handpiece in your ultrasonic cleaner. You'll kind of lift it out of there at some point, and as the ultrasonic cleaning liquid runs out of the handpiece, it'll be orange. Usually, well, obviously that's a sign of rust buildup, and usually that happens for two reasons. One, they're not even using autoclave bags, and if they're not using autoclave bags, they're certainly going to rust the internal lines of the handpiece. Or number two, they are putting them in upside down. So that handpiece is being autoclaved, heated up, and then cooled down with the water vapor still in it. So that too will cause, eventually, that will cause rust buildup as well. Next, you also want to make sure that they're allowing the handpieces to cool naturally. For the autoclave, they can crack the door an inch or so, and for the statum, they simply take that cartridge or tray out and place it on the counter. In both cases, it takes about 20 to 30 minutes to cool properly, and at that point, they can take the handpiece, lube it, use it on a patient. And then the last thing, or the fifth thing that you want to go over with them in the five-step, is the lubrication procedures. Number one, they've got to use the correct lubricant for the handpiece, and a big key is also having that the correct attachment nozzle. As you know, the attachment nozzles perfectly fit whatever handpiece they're using, whether it's the five-hole nozzle for the Midwest style, whether it's a Cavo adapter or a Star adapter or W&H or whatever. If they have the proper nozzle, that's key to making sure that their handpieces get lubricated and cleaned. Now, if they lube prior to sterilization, which is 100% recommended by every manufacturer out there, including us and everyone else, because what that does when they lube prior to sterilization is it takes advantage of the cleaning properties in that can, in that aerosol can, the solvent base to, the liquid that's in that can or the chemical, and that removes the bone, blood, and tissue debris from the handpiece. And you want all of that out of there, and you want the handpiece clean when you sterilize it, obviously. You sterilize it, and then we recommend, although not all the manufacturers do, and Bud and I kind of spin our heads on this one, they don't all recommend that you lube post-sterilization. But if you lubricate post-sterilization, you're really, making sure you've got the maximum amount of lubricant in those bearings. So when they're spinning at 350 to 400,000 RPM, they're definitely got plenty of lube in them. We recommend it, and we guess, just knowing kind of some testing that we did here with our own dentists and then hearing from some of the franchise owners out there, that they're probably going to add about 30% to their handpiece life if they do lubricate, A, before sterilization, and then B, after sterilization. So the five-step checkup and in-office training you provide will definitely increase their handpiece life. It's going to eliminate the warranty issues. It's going to save you money because of the warranty issues that are eliminated, and at the same time, it extends the doctor's handpiece life, saving them time and money. So potentially you're saving them hundreds and, depending on how many handpieces, you know, thousands of dollars per year. How can the manufacturers, supply houses, and most of the independents compete with that and offer that kind of value? Short answer is they can't. I mean, we know that the manufacturers don't do it. We know that the supply houses don't do that. And most of any of the independents you're going to run into out there don't really do that. They're just worried about getting the handpiece, either selling them a new handpiece or providing an overhaul. They don't really look at maximizing the performance of the handpiece by educating the staff on how to take care of them properly. They might sell them a can of lube and walk out the door and hope they use it right. But you're going to go in there and you're going to go through these different steps and you're going to make sure they do that. So we think that the five-step checkup is probably the absolute greatest thing you can do to add value to your offices and save them time and money. But there are some other things that I wanted to talk about too. Yes.
This is Larry Guy. Talking about the lubricating after sterilization, one of my docs, they were adamant, well, we can't do that. We're breaking sterilization if we open the bag. I didn't have a good answer for him on that. So what do you recommend they do as far as lubricating afterwards? Just, you know, open one end of the bag and then, you know, lubricate from that end?
Well, no matter what they do, at some point they have to open the bag and you know, put it on the connector and work on a patient. So
yeah, I mean, they
at some point that bag is getting
open. One end of the bag.
At some point the bag's getting open. So whether they do it right now and lube it, whether they do it 30 seconds before they work on the patient, if they can do that, spray some lube in it, flush it for 15 seconds and use it on the patient, I mean, by now it's been out of the bag for 30 seconds and it's being used on the patient. So I have heard that argument before. At some point you have to open the bag. So I've never understood why they think that makes it unsterile.
Okay.
But they do. Some do. If you can combat that with a little bit of rationale like we just kind of discussed, then go ahead. If you can't, what I would suggest doing is giving them one of those little oil dropper bottles. What in those oil pins, they'll probably be willing to just set one of those oil pins on the tray in the operatory area and just put, have them put 3 drops in the air intake, if they know what that is, before they use it on the patient. And, that'll get a little extra lube in there for the procedure.
Hey, Dave. Dave Reinhardt, I've got an idea,
Dave,
on this.
Oh, I'd love to hear it.
I actually ran into this with one of my good customers, and they're very concerned about sterilization. So what I did is I sold them a can of lube for their lab where they lubricate the handpieces prior to sterilization.
Okay, perfect.
And then I sold them a can of lube for every operatory so that, in the operatory, that can only touches handpieces that have been sterilized. Their concern was that if they used the same can that they used prior to sterilization, they would be contaminating it just prior to use with the patient.
Right.
Seems to have worked.
That's brilliant. I love that idea. I've never heard that before, but you just totally eliminated any other concerns with that.
Okay.
That was a great way to attack that problem, David. For sure. So did those two ideas help at all? That was Larry, right?
Yeah, that was perfect.
Okay.
Great idea.
Maybe a couple suggestions. I like Dave's a lot. Yeah, A, you sell him a couple of more cans of lube, and B, you'd probably can be right in line with something that OSHA would suggest or recommend.
Yeah.
So thanks for that question. That was a good question. So I hope that helped. In addition, kind of moving forward with what we were talking about, we went over the value-added items that are, just a part of your everyday service to the offices in what you do, what I called your expert and superior service. In addition to that, you can talk about your turnaround time. You can repair and return handpieces next day if absolutely required, or 1 to 2 days in most cases. Some manufacturers like Kevo, right now they've got a 6-week turnaround. Midwest is about there. I think they're 4 to 6 weeks. W&H is about 3 to 4 weeks. So, you know, right off the bat, you're just destroying the competition on turnaround time. Many of you also have loaners available to your docs, and that gives them a net downtime of zero. I mean, if you're able to offer a loaner to a doc that's really in need, your turnaround time, it might still be a day or two, but their actual time in office without a handpiece to work on a patient is zero. Who can compete with you on that? I mean,
Dave.
Yeah.
This is Doug up in Massachusetts. I have a dentist that loves that, and he takes advantage of that every time he gives me a handpiece.
That's perfect. So that's why you have that customer, and trust me, he's going to stay with you for life as long as you keep offering that kind of service. I mean, it's just phenomenal, Doug, right?
That's right, and I think that's the reason why I got him as a client.
It's probably the exact reason why you got him. He, if he hasn't done it, I would imagine he'd recommend you to some of his colleagues.
He tells me he does. He talks about me every time. He loves our service. He loves the fact that we're there on the spot for him, and the fact that we do provide. I even have an electric handpiece that I have loaned him while his was down.
Yeah, I mean, along the themes of what we're talking about, I mean, how invaluable is that? For him, it's why he's using you. It's why you have that him as a customer, because you offer
exactly.
That one simple service.
Exactly.
Now,
Hi, Dave. This is Don from San Bernardino.
Yep.
Yeah, I'd like to talk about that 1 to 2 day just for a minute.
Absolutely.
On my initial training, I was kind of more or less led towards the idea that we don't want to give them 1 to 2 days because they're going to expect it every time. So with that said, I also have to admit that the post office is really slowing down. If I don't have parts in stock and I offer them 1 to 2 day turnaround, but it takes me 3 days to, you know, pick up the handpiece, get my parts ordered, get them shipped, get them back here, and get the handpiece repaired, you know, I'm at a minimum of 3 days. If I run into a problem with the handpiece, I'm up to, you know, 4, 6, 8 days. And I have no problem with that because there's always exceptions. But what concerns me is that I tell my customer that I'm going to have their handpiece back to them, you know, in 3 days or 2 days. And then all of a sudden it stretches out to a week, and I'm really feeling like I failed them. That's my comment.
Well, although that's not horrible turnaround time, I would say you're failing them too. If you're, you know, promoting quick turnaround and you can't get them a handpiece back for a week. Now, in some cases where it's a slow speed, where it's just you run into some kind of extraordinary problems where you try ordering a part and that didn't do it, and you order some other part and that didn't do it, and you get Bud and Sean on the phone and go through some tech stuff, you know, I can see that happening. But, I mean, probably 70%+ of the handpieces out there should be, you know, pretty basic in repair, whether it's Midwest or Star or Kevo, where you have, you know, maybe the proper inventory on hand and can get that turned around quicker. So I would hope that in at least 70%+ of the repair, it is that quicker turnaround.
So would you say that I mean, you're saying 70+, let's say 75, is that an acceptable percentage, 25% of letdown, though? I mean,
well, I guess what you and I could do is look at why, you know, what's going on here. I mean, you kind of said you don't have the parts in inventory and the mail takes too long. So it seems like all of that would be eliminated by, you know, me working with you on maybe having a little bit more focused inventory to what your customers have. And then, if needed, you know, the personal pickup and delivery.
Hey, Dave.
This is Jay.
I didn't mean to butt right in there, but in the second year I had my TDC, I kind of ran into the scenario that just being described. And it took me a little bit of time, but I essentially went through and determined like how many Midwest Traditions I'd repair in a month and how many KVO635Bs I'd repair in a month. And I tracked that for 2-3 months, so I kind of had a running average. And then what I did is I built my inventory up for spindle chuck combos that would be required for those hand pieces along with bearings, so that I actually had a little more on the shelf than I'd ever would need at any one time.
Okay.
However, it worked out over the course of a year because every so often I'd get the month where I wound up having 5 or 6 more of those than normal. So
right.
I never ran out. But it was something that I thought, well, and it was an expense that I had to, prepare for and actually budget for. And over the course of time, I did build up the inventory. That was one way to handle that. And now I typically order like twice a month and use FedEx, so I get it the next day. But the FedEx expense on a shipment spread over, a couple $1,000 worth of parts is pretty minimal. So anyway, that was my point.
That's a great point, Jay. And Don, I want to add to that briefly, and that would be this. When you start out with an initial parts kit, we don't know what the handpiece focus is going to be in your area. It's just different everywhere. There's no geographical reason for it. I guess it was all just whoever the best rep was, whether he was a KVO rep or a Midwest rep or a Star rep, in your area, that's what you'll notice is a heavy, heavy concentration. So once you start looking at your customer base and what repairs you're doing, like Jay said, you should focus a little bit of inventory buildup on those items. I know with Mike Young, for example, in Alabama, he was ordering every other day, and he was ordering FedEx. And he called up just upset, saying, "Dave, my shipping costs are just out of control." And so what Steve recommended was this. He said, Mike, do this. Look at what, and we can help you with this because we can run the report for you. Look at what you buy in the course of a month. And every month it seems to be, if you add it up, whether you ordered on a Tuesday or Wednesday or Thursday or whatever, when you get to the end of the month, when you start comparing month after month after month, it was like he was ordering the same quantities of the same items. Every once in a while there'd be a little, kind of an odd duck in there. But for the most part, it was the same thing over and over and over again. So Steve said, "Here's what we'll do, Mike. We'll look at everything you order in a month, typically. We're going to send it to you on the first of the month. Whatever you don't use, send back to us full credit, the whole nine. We made a mistake, but we're gonna do that for you." I honestly don't think Mike Young, and if you're on the line, Mike, you can add in. If not, that's okay. But I don't think he ever sent anything back. It was like clockwork. He had the same customer base with the same hand pieces, although every once in a while there's an odd duck, but it was the same thing over and over and over again. So I can get together with you, Don, after this call. We can go through those items, and we can offer that same thing for you so that you're not turning a handpiece around in a week or so when you could be turning around in a day or two.
That sounds good, and I thank you for your comments. And I'd like to talk to you offline about that some more.
Okay,
thank
perfect.
You.
Thank you very
much,
John. That was great.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah.
Hey, this is John Sisko. Sorry, I had one last thing to add on that to bring value-added side of it.
Yeah.
Well, I think that you always have to manage expectations, and I've only been doing it a year, but when I go in, I try to get them involved in the process by saying that, we typically can turn things around in a short period of time, 2 to 3 days, but, as I learn and work with you and our relationship grows, I will know what you use and stock that inventory and kind of bring them back into it as a teammate, so we're going to be a team member, I'm going to stock things that you have and know, and then, try to just build those layers of trust,
Wow, that was fantastic. What a great thing to say to a staff when that situation comes up. I hope you heard that, Don, because that would be perfect for any time you run into that situation where you let them know, that you'll try to keep stock on hand of those items because they'll need them in the future.
But definitely if you tell them, if I can't get it back to you in 3 days, make sure you call them and let them know you're not going to get it back in 3 days. I've had to order a part. And, you know, the worst thing, I never want a doctor to call me and ask me where my handpiece is, because then I feel like I failed them. But you have to manage your expectations, and if it's not going to happen, you'll know it that day. Call them back up and say, listen, I'm going to have to order the part. Sorry, but that's going to take 2 extra days.
Perfect.
That's it.
No, well, thank you very much, John. It's communication, right? It's good communication with your doc, first and foremost. So like you said, they're not calling you wondering where the handpiece is. If you're on the, you know, I've always thought if you're, you know, on the forefront, or you call them before they call you in any of those situations, you feel like you've got good service from that provider. So for John to take the initiative and pre-call any customer that he thinks is going to take more than 3 days, before they're wondering on a Wednesday or a Thursday or Friday, hey, where the hell is my handpiece? Hell, they already got a phone call from John on, you know, Tuesday evening or Wednesday morning that is going to be a couple of days. So they, almost every time a doctor's office will thank you for the information, and great, you know, we'll see you on Friday or Monday. So keeping them informed and kind of like almost pre-informed is definitely a great value to add to what you're providing them. And the way he talked about stocking inventory specifically for them, for that customer, made them feel good, I'm sure. So thank you very much for that, John. Anyone else want to add on the turnaround time portion of our discussion? Okay. Lastly, I wanted to talk about the third item, which was the more affordable pricing. What you offer to your customers are several things. The basic things are you offer an overhaul, bearing overhaul, or a turbine. Now, when you offer a bearing overhaul, you're automatically kind of going a step further than anything that the manufacturers want to do. I know Shine has an overhaul now. They didn't used to, but now they will even offer a turbine overhaul. But in knowing Shine and knowing people that have worked with Shine, they do everything they can to talk their customers into a new turbine. Why? They charge about $415 for a new Cavo turbine. Well, if they're going to compete with an $89.95 repair that they also offer on a Cavo turbine overhaul, if they just recommend to their customers, just looking at the math, to four customers in a row, they say, well, we can't overhaul your turbine, we need to put a new turbine in it. If they get one out of four of those people to say, yeah, go ahead and throw in the turbine, and the other three tell them no, to go to heck, they'll do something else with them, they're going to be ahead. So it's to their advantage, because it's all a numbers game for these companies like Shine and Patterson and everyone else. They're ahead of the game if they can get one out of every four people to buy the new turbine. If they get two out of four to go with the new turbine, they're just over the top ahead. So that's their only motivation. Even though they offer the overhaul service, they're still, their only motivation, or their main motivation, is to still talk that customer out of any kind of an overhaul and talk them into a new turbine. You don't do that. If it needs an overhaul, you promote the overhaul. If it needs a turbine, you promote the turbine. You promote the service that's appropriate for the repair. They don't. In addition, you offer new aftermarket economy or premium Sable turbines with an OEM option if absolutely required. So you're coming in with a turbine price between the ranges of, let's say, $179.95 and $259.95, and that's for a new turbine, and that's in direct competition with the Shines and the Pattersons out there selling turbines for, you know, $400. So whether they want to go with an overhaul, you're the more affordable option, or if they want to go with the new turbine, you're the more affordable option. In addition, you offer all kinds of other services. Head dent and back end threads were a couple I came up with just off the top of my head for between $50 and $100. So that essentially saves the handpiece. The manufacturer and supply houses, what do they want to do? They all want to sell the doctors new handpieces. So if it comes in with a dented head, chances are they're going to tell the doctor the head's dented, and they'll give them a $100 trade-in on a new handpiece. If the threads are bad, I don't even think they offer a back-end thread replacement. So, I mean, in that exact, just that small instance right there, you just saved your doc hundreds of dollars. So, you know, the value-added service is what you can do to save your customers time and money. Everything you do for your customers on a day-in and day-out basis, from educating them and their staff on proper maintenance to quickly repairing their handpieces and getting them back to them, even offering a loaner if needed, to offering more affordable repairs and far greater repair options, you're saving them time and money and are thus providing them with great value to that portion of their business. I mean, in essence, other than their own staff and customers, you can become that office's greatest asset. So if that didn't convince you that you're just providing everything that a doctor's office could possibly want out of a handpiece repair company, I don't know what would. All of those things are the value-added items that basically put you a step above the competition. There were some other things Clyde and I talked about being more of an expert on, you know, troubleshooting handpieces and what's going on in the offices and why their handpieces are failing. And, of course, we can get real, real in-depth on that if we need to in a future conversation. But
I'll tell
any
you something,
questions,
Dave,
on that?
This is Doug again. I just returned 3 handpieces to a brand-new client, and first of all, I got to say that there's a lot of unhappy dentists out there that they're very unhappy with the big boys. And these people, when I went in, were genuine Patterson haters. And I returned the handpieces, but they were full of rust. And what you told me today has piqued my interest in going back in and working with the doc to find out why there's so much rust in there. And I have a sneaking suspicion it has to do with the way they're autoclaving. So I just want to say, hey, thanks for that. This is really going to build some more credibility with these people.
Yeah, you're very welcome. Obviously, if you have any kind of a rust buildup in handpiece, you're having a water issue. The handpiece is typically getting autoclaved or sterilized with water inside of it. Whether the staff is washing the handpiece under a sink with a little brush before they put it in the autoclave, or whether they're not using an autoclave bag, or whether they're turning it on upside down. I mean, these are the kinds of things where if you go through and you just offer that quick, you know, I say quick, you'll probably be in the office for 10 or 15 minutes going through this 5-step checkup with them. But that's one of the things you'll discover right away, because when you have Lisa or Cindy or whoever show you how they, you know, maintain their handpiece, you're going to immediately see what they're doing wrong. Just a real quick follow-up, I did that my own dentist, who I hadn't had any kind of warranty issues with for the 6 years I've worked with them, started having some warranty issues. And the reason was the gal that was in charge of their handpiece maintenance, who I had worked with initially and over the years, got pregnant and went on maternity leave. Anyway, she ended up quitting, which happened. So they had some staff turnover. They had a new girl in there, and they started running into warranty issues. So I walked in, I said, Nicole, can you show me what you do with a handpiece? So she grabs the handpiece, and she puts one drop of lube in the air exhaust tube and one drop of Midwest lube in the chuck. And she goes, that's how I lubricate it. And I said, that's why you're having warranty problems. And, you know, I mean, she had cans of lube there that I had provided for them, but she was using a little Midwest dropper bottles of oil again. So I took those, put them in the back of the cabinet, didn't throw them away. I just said, here, you know, I'm not throwing them away, but you need to use these lubricant cans with the specific nozzles on them for the hand pieces. I worked with her no more than 5 minutes. And this was back in, as I mentioned earlier in our discussion, this was back in, I think, March of this year, now 2011. And I got a hand piece from her in April. It was unrelated to any kind of warranty issue. But I haven't had a handpiece from them since April. I mean, they haven't had a warranty problem. I fixed handpieces for them in January, March, and April, and here we are this January. We'll probably get some from them, you know, any time now, but no warranty issues. I was in there about 3 weeks ago for a cleanup, and, you know, of course I asked her, hey, everything working okay? Any handpieces down? Nope, everything's great. So it's just a 5 or 10 minutes you spend with these gals, you know, educating them on properly maintaining their handpieces, and it's just, it does a world of good. So if there's anything you think of doing to add value to your customers, it would be to go into each office individually and work with that maintenance person for 5 to 10 minutes, and that's enough.
Thanks so much for that.
Yeah, you're very welcome. And so if you want to do that, Doug, please give me a call. I can kind of talk to you about exactly how to do that, how to go about it.
Well, I definitely want to call you back, too, because I need some more coaching on what to look for while I'm in there.
Okay.
Thanks.
Love to help you with that, for sure.
Thanks, Doug.
You're very welcome.
Dave, I've got one thing that I do with my largest customer that I'd like to talk about.
Oh, I'd love to hear it, Dave.
This is Larry.
Oh, sorry, Larry. Sounded like Dave Pearson.
Yeah, no problem. My largest customer has 42 Midwest Quiet Air Standards that they seem to manage to lose chucks out of all the time, and they're on the verge now of buying new handpieces. So what I did is I took that entire inventory and the repair history into them and gave them a report so they could see, one, how many times each one had been repaired and what the primary cause for that repair was. And I was able to show them that more than 50% of their repairs have something to do with either a missing chuck, which has thrown bearings out of whack or whatever. And so they're going to use that to determine which hand pieces to repair and which ones to hang on to and which ones to replace. So, you know, we've got a few that are, no matter what you do, you just can't get the things balanced. They're always going to have a squeal or a vibration, even if you replace the whole turbine. Those are the ones we're going to focus on.
Well, the great opportunity there. Number one, that was awesome that you did that for them. They're probably very grateful for that. And you could even recommend, if they keep losing the chucks, to convert them over to a lever style or a push button. A, they're easier to use, and B, they'll never lose a chuck again.
Yeah. I've tried to talk them into that, but they also are looking at fiber optics. So today they have our two demo hand pieces in hand. So I'll be calling you about the hoses and lighting for those later on today.
Yeah, well, that's great that you did that. I mean, that's a great service that you just if you can educate the doctors and the staff, I mean, that's just an invaluable tool and thing you can do to make yourself part of the team, for sure. So that probably solidified that relationship as well, right?
I'm hoping. I'm hoping I get these new sales.
I would think so. Well, that's great. Thank you, Larry.
Dave, Don again.
Don, yes, sir.
Yes. I'd like to talk about price just a little bit. I've got this standard price list.
Mm-hmm.
We're asking $89.95 for overhauls. And up the line. And I'm getting some comments from a lot of my customers, or potential customers, I should say. They're telling me they're getting overhauls for as little as 30, which is totally ridiculous, obviously.
Uh-huh.
Some are telling me overhauls for 60 to 70. Actually, quite a few are telling me overhauls from 60 to 70. And I know we have a value added, and I always tell them about this. But in the same respect, I've just recently, in December, I did a campaign for 20% off all Midwest Quiet Air and Traditionals. So I was offering overhauls for $71.96. And my response wasn't nearly as good as I thought it would be. Either I'm presenting it wrong or my price is still off. And I hope not everybody in the country is having the same problem, but how do we really determine what our price level is in the area without really pushing everybody to tell us or all my customers to tell me exactly how much are you paying, what are you getting, so on and so forth, because that becomes very difficult. Half the time they don't even know.
Well, if they don't even know, why would they be getting, if they don't even know what they're paying, then they wouldn't not be using you based on price, right?
Well, they're basically, I shouldn't say they don't know. They don't know what they're getting. They know that they're sending their hand pieces in. They're getting them fixed. They're getting them back. How long are they lasting? I don't know. You know, what are they doing? Are they shining up the shells? Are they doing this, doing that? And they're like, well, they work when they come back.
And they
I suspect in a lot of cases, and I know I have one guy called Repair Makers and a couple others. One guy's called Ernie and another guy's the guy out in Victorville and so forth. And I suspect a lot of these people are going in there and, like I say, making them work. They're not replacing bolt bearings, the O-rings, and cleaning the shells and you know, buffing them up and so forth. But neither does the customer. And of course, I always tell them I do, but if they work, they work. If they don't work, they don't work. So anyway, I guess my real question is, how do I determine what my price level should be?
Well, I think you should at least try as hard as you can to maintain your current pricing. If a company is going to come in there and do a repair for $60, then you know you have to kind of educate your customer on why you're slightly higher, but you might provide an exponential amount of greater service and value to their company and to their handpiece repair. So at that point, it just becomes a promotion, a self-promotion on your part of the superior service and that you provide. There's always going to be some guy out there that's doing a cheaper repair. If you sit there and just chase every guy that drives by and offers a cheap repair, you're going to have a hard time making it. I guess I would hope there would be some insight from some of our fellow franchise owners that have run into that problem and how they combated it.
Dave, can I make a mention on that?
Absolutely.
This is Doug again. I had a client who called me up one day, and this is my first time doing business with her, and she went on this tangent about my pricing and what's customary. I said, ma'am, I beg your pardon, but this is my business. I run the business the way I see fit. And I'm sure you run your business the way you see fit. And she is now one of my best clients.
And what was
That's
her
the price equation right out of the picture?
Her complaint was her that your pricing was
that my pricing. First of all, she mostly that she didn't like my pricing, and that she could get it done someplace else, and I should do this and I should do that to satisfy her desires. And that's when I said, I'm sorry, ma'am, but this is my business. I run it the way I see fit, and I'm sure you do the same with yours. And she has not gone to anybody else, and she gives us all her work.
That's all you had to say to her to get her business?
That's all I had to say to her. I beg
wow.
your pardon, ma'am, but this is my business. I run it as I see fit, and you run yours the way you see fit.
Hey,
wow.
Dave.
That's pretty amazing. Yes.
Hey, Dave, this is John Cisco again. I think I trained with you, Don, back last year. But what I would do, well, I've never come across a pricing issue yet in 13 months of anybody saying that they were getting it lower. But if I was, maybe just thinking out loud, I would find out who they're using. I think you have found the names, and maybe call that company acting like a doctor and see really what they charge. Do a little digging in as far as I've called Shine. I've called all these places and ask them, say, I'm Dr. John Cisco. And I'd like to know what you charge for an overhaul. What do you get or something? I mean, that's kind of extreme, but I don't know that. Even here in the South, I don't ever see anybody giving away things for $60, So it might sound a little fishy to me.
Thanks, John. I think it is possible. I know I've heard from different parts of the country where guys are running around. Some of the van guys are driving around and offering, $59 overhauls in the parking lot there. And typically what you run into there is they're just doing a quick slap-it-together repair. They're not properly ultrasonically cleaning the handpiece, making sure all the lines are clear and clean. In some cases, like, Don said, they might just take both bearings off. Hey, the back bearing feels pretty good. They put that bearing right back on and just change the front bearing. I mean, I've heard all the horror stories and goofy stuff that these guys do to try and save a dime so that they can offer that cheaper repair. And what typically happens is either they're offering, you know, a basically not a proper repair, and they're cutting corners to save on costs. So typically what happens is the doctor's handpiece doesn't last as long, so usually these guys are sitting there offering a lower warranty period, and, you know, B, they're not quick to do the warranty work. So there's always a deficiency in their service in some way, or their typical is. So I guess the thing that Don's running into is he knows that, but what's happening is his doctors either don't know that or don't care about that. They get the handpiece back and it works. If they don't do any kind of tracking on their end on warranty, then they can't differentiate, you know, his repair from some fly-by-night guy's repair to even a factory turbine if somebody put it in. They would not know the difference. So in that case, it's got to become kind of an educational process where you really educate them and promote that your service is that much better, Don. If somebody has something else to add to that, I'd love to hear it.
Well, I think you're right, Dave. I think I need to really concentrate on the five-step checkup and maybe add, three, four, or five more steps to a follow-up. Checkup, then follow-up.
Absolutely. One of the things that Steve had me do when we what we did initially when we moved down here to Southern California is we attended a couple of the dental shows to try and get a small customer base so that we have experience like you guys do working with doctors on a regular basis. Now, we didn't do anything like trying to build up a huge customer base, but we had about 15 to 20 docs that we serviced here, you know, right around our office here within about a 5-mile radius. And it just became kind of an invaluable tool to, you know, to being able to find things out. And one of the things that Steve would have us do is, at the time, I think we had, like everyone, a 3-month warranty. So what we would do is we would call the office at 3 months and find out if their handpiece was working. And then, of course, because they haven't called you, typically their handpiece is still working. If it wasn't working, they'd have called you. So you knew with your follow-up call almost every time you were getting good news back from them. And then you looked like you were kind of pre-calling them about any kind of warranty issues and following up with them. And no other companies do that. The independents don't do that. The manufacturers don't do that. I know a lot of you guys can't do that maybe on a time basis, but especially when you're starting out, I think that's a great thing to do. Hey, you know, I fixed your handpiece. We're at the 3-month warranty. Just want to make sure it's still working great for you and everything's good. And it's almost always going to be a good call because you know it's working well because they would have called you otherwise. And it's such kind of an coming from right field kind of a tactic. They're not used to it. It's going to make them feel good about the service you're providing. And, heck, they might even have a handpiece that's down that they need you to fix.
Yeah, I have to agree with that.
So
I've done that about 10 to 20% of the time, and I get really good results from that.
Cool.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah.
It's Dave Reinhardt again. Just a thought about the pricing and how I've addressed some questions about pricing. Mainly comes up in a discussion of the price of a turbine. And first of all, I only use the Timken spindles,
okay.
I tell my customers that that's my standard repair, that it's the only thing I use because I know while I may put a turbine in this time, the next time it gets repaired, it's going to be an overhaul, and more than likely it's going to be an overhaul the time after that. So if they look at the total cost of the repairs over the life of those three repairs, it's going to be lower than if I use cheaper parts and charge them less up front because I know from experience those other parts will fail more quickly. Mm-hmm. So it kind of puts doubt in the minds of those people about the quality of the repairs that are cheaper. And, in fact, I think I'm giving them accurate information, and that is, you know, I'm focusing on the value, the long-term cost of the maintenance of their handpieces, and not just the initial cheap price. That seems to work. And then on occasion, I've told people I could charge less, but I would have to order parts that I don't stock in order to offer you that price. It works. And the third thing I've done is I've gone into Shine's website and I've printed out the information that's there for all of us, which shows the cost of turbines for various handpieces, either, for example, the OEM Cavos or their easy install turbines, and shown people the prices of just the part if they were to buy the part. And, you know, invariably my price is $10 or $20 more than the part, and then I focus on the service.
Well, that's an excellent tactic because you're just showing them proof of your, A, better pricing, and then you're promoting the better parts, too, in your service.
Yeah, because, you know, I mean, part of what our literature says is that we only use premium parts. You know, and there you can just launch right into the value of the service we provide.
I agree. Well, as quickly as an hour went by. So thank you guys very much for your participation. It was another great meeting. As always, I will download this conversation and send you all a link to that file so that you can listen to this discussion again and again, if desired, and I hope you all have a great day. Thank you all for participating. Bye.
Take care, David.
Thank you. Thank you, guys. Bye. Bye.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, guys.